Hey, it's Guy here. So, you know how there's a place in your town or city where they do amazing pizzas or barbecue or tacos so great that the line snakes out the door? Well, that's kind of what Jerry Morrell had in mind when he wanted to open Five Guys. One place, burgers and fries, keep it simple. And he deliberately looked for a hole in the wall, somewhere kind of out of the way, because he thought if you can get people to come there, then you know you've got something pretty great. We first ran this episode in June of 2017. It's a really fun one, and I hope you enjoy it. How did you even know how to make a burger? I mean, were you a good home chef? Was anybody in your family a good chef?
Listen, you come from my hometown. You can't make a burger. You can't live. So, I mean, we knew how to make burgers. I knew how to cook a potato. That was about it.
You knew how to grill a burger and how to fry potatoes.
Yeah.
And that's all you really needed to know how to do.
That's all we knew.
From NPR, it's How I Built This, a show about innovators, entrepreneurs, idealists, and the stories behind the movements they built. I'm Guy Raz, and on today's show, how a tiny family-run burger joint in suburban Virginia became one of the fastest-growing restaurant chains in American history. So Jerry's going to move a little closer to that mic, right? Yeah. So Jerry, get a little bit closer.
Okay.
And can you see me okay?
Yeah.
Yeah? You ready?
No.
Okay. introduce yourself, please. If I met you at a party, I'd say, who are you? What's your name?
I'm Jerry Morrell.
And what do you do?
Sell hamburgers.
So this is the founder of Five Guys Burgers and Fries. Jerry Morrell is 73 years old, and it's been a long journey to get to where he is today. He was born in a small mining town in northern Michigan. And Jerry says when he was a kid, his dad wasn't around that much.
He was a... an adventurer. He wasn't very family oriented. He was a stunt pilot. That's probably why my mom and him got a divorce fairly early.
Jerry went to Catholic school as a kid, where he says he was not the best student.
I was a terrible student. I didn't like school. In fact, I can remember the nuns used to say, you know, you're going to end up selling hamburgers someday, so you don't work hard.
Anyway, Jerry did get through school, and eventually he went on to study at the University of Michigan.
I got scared there. I said, my God, how am I going to make it in this world with all these smart people around? In fact, I was more intimidated after I got out of college than ever.
So after college, Jerry moved back to his hometown, and he married his high school girlfriend. He got a job selling life insurance, and they had three sons. But the marriage didn't last. His wife ended up leaving and taking the kids to Florida. And for Jerry, that was a low point. Kind of floated around for a while, lived in different cities. He wasn't sure what he was going to do with his life. But he was sure of one thing.
Well, one thing I was sure of is I was going to get my kids back.
You wanted your kids to live with you?
Right.
How are you going to do that?
Well, I didn't know yet.
Around the mid-1970s, Jerry was offered a consulting job in the D.C. area, so he took it, and he moved to Alexandria, Virginia. And that's where he met his second wife, Janie. And after a situation stabilized a bit, his kids did actually come to live with him. And it was also around that time when Jerry decided to become a financial planner.
I was shocked at how much money there was in the D.C. area, so I said, I'm going to go back in the financial planning business. And I got my degree from Bryn Mawr and started selling financial products to people in the D.C. area. That's what I did.
So the boys move in with you.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, you've got five people. You've got a household of five people.
Right.
And that was basically what you did? You were a financial planner?
I was a financial planner. I tried a few businesses. I started an oil business in Texas, and I did a couple other dumb things. I tried to start a water business, of all things. I thought selling bottled water back then would have been a good idea. And everybody laughed at me. I had a hard time raising money.
This is in the early 80s?
Late, middle 70s. The worst one was oil, because I started a company and I went down to Texas and found out that they were waiting for me because I was from the East and they're going to take all my money. and then my wife and I went into the real estate business, and we were we were experts at buying real high and then waiting until it crashed and trying to get rid of it.
Okay, so if I get this right, you were doing financial planning as your main job, but you'd had like all these business ideas that you would try out on the side?
Yeah.
And basically none of them worked out.
Right, right. I really didn't know what I was doing. I'm just lucky that I got in the hamburger business.
So how does Five Guys begin? What's the genesis of it?
You want to hear the short side or the long side?
No, I want the long side.
Well, where I grew up, there was a guy named Push 'Em Up Tony. And Push 'Em Up Tony had a little tiny hamburger place with a picnic table in it. And he had a grill, and he didn't sell anything except hamburgers. And he always seemed happy. And it stuck in the back of my mind, because people used to come from all over town to get hamburgers there. And then when I moved to Washington, I saw something I just couldn't believe was Ocean City, Maryland. Hmm. And they had a place, and they were selling boardwalk fries. There's a place there called Thrasher's. And there must have been 20 places selling boardwalk fries, but only one place had a long line. Hmm. And that was Thrasher's. The line was 100 feet long all day long. So me and the kids, that got into our mind, like, you know, hamburgers and fries, keep it simple, might work. And that's where the idea came from.
So what did you do? Did you go to your wife and say, let's try a burger joint?
Yes.
So what'd she say?
Probably the same thing the banks said at the time. Are you guys out of your mind? But we did it a little different. We said, let's not put a lot of money into it. Mm-hmm. And let's find a place where the rent is real low, out of the way, where nobody can see it. Mm-hmm. And everybody said, why would you want to do it that way? And we said, well, if we can put it where it's hard to find, but if we can get people coming there, then we know we got something.
And this was in 1986, right?
Yes.
So where was the first location?
Columbia Pike and Glebe Road in Arlington,
Virginia. Yeah. And it was like a little place and rent was cheap. And how much money did you have to put up to...
With our first store, we put $35,000 in.
And what did that cover?
Everything.
The rent and the equipment?
The equipment. We found junk equipment, rebuilt it ourselves. It was stand-up only. And Chad and Matt were still in high school. In fact, Chad was, I think, maybe 13 or something. And I said, I got some money saved up for college, if you want to go to college. And they pretty much said, no, we'd rather do something else.
Wait, go back for a second. You sat your kids down, and you had your kids' college fund, and you said to them, hey, look, I got this college money. I will send you to college, or you cannot go to college, and we can use it to open up a burger joint.
Right.
Were you, you can imagine today, like, a parent saying that to their kids, and then other parents saying, you're mortgaging your kids' future on this burger joint?
Yes.
Did you have any of that feeling in your mind, like, maybe this is not a great idea?
No.
No.
No, if something was telling us it was the right thing to do. Probably, you look back on it, was probably a silly, it was kind of.
It was kind of crazy.
It was crazy. It didn't seem crazy to us. For some reason, we all seemed to be on board with it.
Yeah.
And now I was really surprised because the kids jumped right in and worked hard, and Janie worked hard. She kept all the books, and I was amazed how the kids jumped into it.
And what is the story with the name? How did you come up with
one of my lawyers said you should incorporate, and you need to have a name as he fills out the papers. Well, this was so well thought out that we didn't have a name. So me and Janie and the boys said, We had three sons plus one more son with Janie. My fifth son wasn't born yet. So it was four sons and me. So we said, well, we'll call it Five Guys for now, and then we'll change it. As soon as we get the papers filled out, we'll change it. And the lawyer said, okay.
Okay, so on your first day, the opening day, 1986, did you guys have like a grand opening?
No, we didn't. And when we first opened up at 11 o'clock, there was no business at all until 11:45. And then one person finally walked in, and 12:30, we were almost packed.
Wow.
And we made money from our very first day. And We were breaking even. We were paying our rent.
And you didn't have any employees, right? Because everybody was in the family.
We had a couple employees, but mostly it was the kids, and we were paying them some. I think at the time we were paying them $7.50 an hour or something like that.
How did you even know how to make a burger? I mean, were you a good home chef? Was anybody in your family a good chef?
Listen, you come from my hometown, you can't make a burger, you can't live. So, I mean, we knew how to make burgers. And from where I'm from, is Posen was right near us, and they raised potatoes. I grew up on a farm that we raised a lot of potatoes. I knew how to cook a potato, and we knew how to cook a hamburger. That was about it.
You knew how to grill a burger and how to fry potatoes.
Yeah.
And that's all you really needed to know how to do.
That's all we knew.
Where did you guys get the ingredients from, like the potatoes and all the stuff? Like, how did you know how to source this stuff?
We went to Threshers in Ocean City and looked on the potato bags, and we found out they came from Rigby, Idaho. A guy named Rick Miles was a small potato dealer out there, so we got a hold of him, and we said, would you sell us potatoes? We did not know at the time that he was small. Now he's become a multimillionaire because we buy all our potatoes from him.
And what was so special about his potatoes?
They were sold by Threshers in Ocean City.
So you thought, hey, if there's a line outside this potato joint, their potatoes must be good.
Right. Must be good.
What was Five Guys offering at that time? Was it burgers with all the toppings and all that stuff?
Well, what we did with the kids, Janie and I would not tell the kids how much we were paying for the product. We said, whatever pickles you want to put on the hamburgers, you guys pick the pickles. So they would try different brands and different pickles, and finally they'd end up with the most expensive pickles there were. And we wouldn't say anything about it. We'd say, okay, if that's the pickles you want, buy those pickles.
They would just buy them at the supermarket?
Yeah, at first.
Okay.
Then we said, well, buy the most expensive cooking oil you want to cook in. And it was peanut oil, because that's where they cooked them out in Ocean City. They wanted to buy this bread from a little baker in Arlington that made really good bread, Brenner's Bakery. They're probably the best bakery in Arlington at the time. But for a restaurant business, that would be expensive. We were paying about seven times for a hamburger bun as McDonald's was then.
And what was a burger going for in 1986?
I think we were selling something for like three times, four times what McDonald's was selling for, which everybody said we were crazy. We wouldn't make it that way. But we didn't let the kids know how much we were paying for any of the food. So they would just go out there and whatever it was, if they liked it, that's the way it was.
And what was the thinking behind that strategy?
The thinking was that they're going to pick the best product. They're going to pick what the customer likes, what they liked. Give you an example how ridiculous it is. The kids liked a certain kind of mayonnaise because it was thick and it would hold things together. And we were buying our mayonnaise at the time from a guy up in New York City that was really hard to get along with. And so when we hired our first purchasing agent, he said, there's no way that mayonnaise is this important. No way, because this guy was so hard to deal with. So we had all the family come in and do a blind mayonnaise taste. And to this day, I can't eat mayonnaise by itself. So we had like nine different dishes with mayonnaise, and you tend to take a little spoon, and everybody would taste the mayonnaise blindfolded. And he'd say, I'm going to prove to you that you can't tell the difference in this mayonnaise or any other mayonnaise, you know. And after we took our blindfolds off, my wife, myself, and all the boys picked the same mayonnaise.
Wow.
He couldn't believe it. And it was the mayonnaise we were getting from New York. So Janie and I, what we would do is at the end of the month, we'd look at the sales, and then we'd look at how much we paid for the food, and we'd say, we got to raise our prices. The kids didn't know why we were raising the prices, but we would always say, food costs would stay around 30%. Whatever we got to do, if we got to raise prices, we raise prices. And we said, if we have to worry about price, we don't want to be in this business.
Okay, so you've got this first burger joint, right? And and how do people find out about it? How do people even know about it?
The only way would be somebody else telling them.
They said, there's this great burger place, this little like walk-up shack. You got to try it.
Right. That's the only way they would have found out about it. There was a place in D.C. when I first moved here. I had an office downtown, that lunch and breakfast, but it was downstairs, and it was an alley. And there was nothing on the door, if I remember right, just a steel door coming off the alley. But all the offices around there would go to this place, and it was unmarked, and it was an alley. And I was always impressed with the fact that that guy could do that much business up there, and I knew him. I knew how much money he was making. And he sold it, and within 3 months, it was gone. The people were going there for the food, and it was working. And I said, well, heck, if that guy can do that, then... You know, we'll just open up in a corner, and if people like us, they'll come, and if they don't like us, they won't, and then we won't be in the business.
Coming up, how Five Guys did stay in business, and how they grew way beyond Virginia, even though the last person who wanted to do that was Jerry. Stay with us. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to How I Built This from NPR. Hey everyone, just a quick thanks to two of our sponsors who help make this podcast possible. First, to Carta. Startup equity data is tracked on a cap table, but many cap tables are broken and inaccurate, which makes it difficult to raise a round, offer liquidity, stay compliant, and keep track of who owns what. Carta simplifies how startups and investors manage equity, track cap tables, and get valuations. NPR listeners can get a free 409A valuation when you sign up for Carta's cap table software. For more information, visit carta.com/built. Thanks also to E-Trade. You want to invest your money, but there's one problem. You're not sure where to begin. Luckily, there's E-Trade. E-Trade simplifies investing without the financial jargon. Plus, their easy-to-use platform keeps you in the know about your money at all times. And if you need a hand at any point, E-Trade's investment professionals are standing by to help. For more information, visit etrade.com/NPR. E-Trade Securities, LLC, member FINRA, SIPC.
This is Peter Sagal. When we began Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, we dreamed that our rude jokes would be, in the end, the appropriate way to talk about the news. And look! It happened. Listen to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me on the NPR One app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, welcome back to How I Built This from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. So Jerry and his sons opened up a tiny burger joint in Arlington, Virginia. And at first, people knew about it through word of mouth. But of course, eventually, newspapers started to write about the burgers, and then the lines started to get longer. So Jerry and his family started to think about opening a second location. But they needed the money to finance it.
I can remember going in the bank, and they said, you're going to do what? I said, I want to open another hamburger place. And it was just, they laughed at us. So my sons said, we got friends that their parents got a little bit of money and they know Five Guys is doing good. Maybe we'll ask them for a few thousand. So we got about 150, 200 people that would be willing at any one time to give us money.
But not as investors, just for loans.
We did it a different way. We did it as investors. We'd say, give us $5,000. We'll give you a certain percentage of the gross, never the profit, because there was always too many ways to get cheat people that way. So I said, we'll give you a certain percentage of the gross. We'll give you the money every single month. And anytime you want your money back, you can have it. And everybody said, well, that's stupid, because if you have a blip, everybody's going to come in and ask for the money back. But my method to my madness was also that I said to them, anytime I want to pay you back, I can. Because I knew someday, if this thing was successful, I was going to get better financing. I can go back to these people and pay them back anytime I wanted.
So you never gave them, so they weren't equity owners?
Not in a real sense. We just made a note, said, if this store does $20,000 a week, you get a certain percentage out every week. And we gave them the money exactly on time every month so that we could always go back and ask for more money.
So how much money did you raise to do store number two?
Well, for store number two, we probably only had to raise maybe $150,000. But we had a lot of people that just wanted to throw money at us.
Because they liked the burgers? They liked what you were doing?
Well, they liked the fact that we were making money and they were getting paid every month. I had about 75 people I didn't even know on that list. And I used to say to every one of them, don't put your money in somebody else's business. And they were just, it seemed like a lot of people saw something in Five Guys.
Were you fully committed to this, or did you
No.
still doing financial planning?
I'm still doing financial planning.
At what point do you say to your kids and your wife, you know, I'm going to give up my job and I'm going to focus on Five Guys full time?
Well, that was almost the day I got hit in the head with a broom. I must have been having a bad day at the office or something. And I went home and I said, my wife, I quit. And she said, you got to be crazy. And I said, no, I'm done. I'm not going to work anymore. I'm just going to concentrate on the burger business. And she was pretty upset.
Because she thought this is too risky?
Yes.
But you thought, I think we can make this work.
Well, I thought it was fun.
Yeah.
I always told my kids, I said, you don't have to be in this business. If you want to be, make sure it's fun. Pick something you like to do in the business.
Okay, so now it was like the entire family focusing full-time on Five Guys.
Yep.
What like roles did everybody play?
Well, Janie is like a general. I mean, she is very organized. She runs the office and everything. But my kids were able to go to investors. And so I kind of, if it wasn't for them and my wife, there would be no Five Guys. I didn't build Five Guys. I used to sit around thinking, God, look at this thing. It's growing so fast. I can't believe it, you know. They came up with most of the new ideas, and they pretend they listen to me.
So I've lived in the Washington, D.C. area for a long time, off and on. And I remember, you know, driving to Virginia in like, 1999, 2000 to get a Five Guys burger in Virginia when it was still just, what, four or five
right.
locations. 2002, up until 2002, you grew up to five shops.
Five.
And were you doing pretty well? Were you all making a decent living at that point? You guys must have been rich.
No.
You weren't.
But the thing is, we had figured out the nuts and bolts of the business by then. Most franchisers start off to franchise. We didn't start off to franchise. We had no idea we were going to do that. We started off to build a family business. And we put 17 years into it, and we figured out how to do it right.
Yeah.
So when it came time to franchising, I mean, we had a perfect system.
So how did you then at that point say, you know, hey, let's franchise, let's build this thing out?
My sons came to me about in the late 1990 and started trying to convince me to franchise. And I was dead set against it, really dead set against it, because I didn't think there was any way I could convince other people to do what we were doing.
So how did they change your mind?
Well, there was a guy named Mark Mosley that was selling franchises for another company. He had been watching Five Guys for a while. And my kids got me to meet with him. I didn't want to do it.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, they bought me a book called Franchising for Dummies. It was written by Dave Thomas.
Oh, the guy from Wendy's.
Yeah, the guy from Wendy's.
Yes, okay.
And so I read it, and I... The legal stuff was amazing, all the rules you had to follow and everything.
Yeah.
So they talked me into it.
Why didn't you want to do it?
Because when you start franchising, first of all, telling a franchisee that you're not going to worry about food costs, sounds pretty stupid. You're going to tell a franchisee that you're not going to advertise? That sounds pretty stupid. You're going to tell them that you're only going to sell hamburgers and french fries? You know, they're all going to say, wait a minute, we got to be open later, we got to sell alcohol, we got to watch food costs, we got to shop around for our products. And I said, I don't do that. And I said, we buy from people and we're going to stick with them. That was all hard to sell to franchisees. But we got through that. And I remember Mark coming in because he was going to be our salesman. He said he was going to sell, I can't remember how many stores the first year they were going to sell. But I said, no, just cut that in half. If you're going to sell 50, just cut it down to 25. You don't have to sell 50. And I think within a year and a half or 2 years, we sold 3,500. We sold the whole United States.
So wait, but I mean, your burgers were still a lot more expensive than like a McDonald's burger.
Absolutely.
And it took a lot longer to get a burger there, right? Like you it's not instant. It's not steamy.
No,
right?
No.
It takes longer to get a burger. So, I mean, the business model is different. So were you worried? I mean, did you ever think, you know, maybe this works in Northern Virginia, but I'm not sure this is going to work somewhere else?
Absolutely. It scared the heck out of us. You were talking about the long wait. We used to have a sign in one of our stores that said, if you're in a hurry, there are a lot of really good burger places near here. And everybody said, oh my God, you can't put that sign up. And it helped.
Yeah.
I remember the first franchise store we opened up was in Richmond. Mm-hmm. And I said, oh my God, Richmond. Nobody's going to know who we are in Richmond.
Yeah.
I couldn't even sleep the night before. Richmond, that's like down the road 90 miles. It's nothing.
Yeah.
But I couldn't even sleep. I said, nobody's going to know who we are. And Richmond store was successful. And then they said, well, now we're going to go to North Carolina and South Carolina. I said, nobody knows who we are down there. And I said, no way we're going to Florida because people will never buy that product in Florida because they're older people. And Florida's are, we got 100 stores in Florida or something.
I mean, the idea of going from 5 stores in 2002 to thousands of stores within a year or 2 years.
Well, we didn't go to thousands of stores. We sold franchises. Those are still being built out. In the United States, we've got about 1,400 of them built out now. But all the territory in the United States is gone.
Was that just mind-boggling to you?
Mind-boggling. Mind-boggling. And I was so proud of my kids that didn't go to their head. They're still my kids. They work just like they used to. They work hard every day.
And what is it, I mean, what is it like to work with your 5 sons and your wife? I mean, they're all involved in the company. What, do each do a different thing for the company?
Well, I have one son that just loves doing stuff in the stores, like making sure they're painted right and decorated right. And he's really into that.
So that's his job.
That's what he does mostly.
Yeah.
And I got another one that's a fanatic about the food. And so he goes around the world putting on shows and how to cook things right and stuff. And I got another son that he's really into the financing part of it. He grabbed it, and I'm glad because I don't understand a lot of it, especially this international finance. Everybody's kind of found their own little niche, you know. And my grandkids, I got 4 grandkids working in the business. They all, some of them like teaching, some of them like working in the field. And one of them just loves taking care of, making sure there's no foodborne illness. She's just a fanatic about it, and she loves doing it. And so I let them find what they want to find. And if there's a gap that can't be filled by them, then we'll hire somebody.
Is your family still the primary owner of the company?
Yes. We own about 75% of the company, me and my family. But we took in a fairly big investor when we first started franchising. They don't interfere in our business at all. They gave us a big chunk of money. They're entrepreneurs, too, and they saw something in 5 Guys.
What percentage of the actual restaurants do you guys own? Does 5
we
Guys?
We own, out of about 1,500 restaurants, we have a joint venture in Great Britain and France and Germany where we own, with our partner, half. That's about 60 stores. And then over here, we own about 450 out of the 1,400.
So how many countries total is 5 Guys in now?
We're in Great Britain, which I guess is still one country for now.
Right, you're in the UK.
And we've got 60 stores there. We're doing France. Mm-hmm. We just opened up in Champs-Élysées. Got a store in Madrid. We got several stores in the Middle East. So I think a lot of people, when they get a little bit successful, they look back and try to figure out how they did it. I can't figure it out.
You still don't know?
No.
Do you think a lot of it was luck?
Oh, my God, yeah. 2 things I give a lot of credit to. I'm a great believer in intuition or a higher power or God or whatever you want to call it. I'm a great believer in listening to my hunches. And I couldn't have done it on my own, that's for sure. My kids, I'm luckier than heck I got my kids and my wife because it seems like to me, without them, we'd have done nothing. But we were lucky, real lucky, real, real lucky.
Really your vision was not to open up a burger joint. Your vision was to get your kids to live with you when you and your wife divorced.
Right.
Which that was your real success, getting your kids to
come
live
with
you.
I think so. Yeah, the best thing that's ever happened in my life is my kids. There's no doubt about that. And the best thing that's happened to their mother, which is my ex-wife, is the fact that they're able to do all kinds of wonderful things for her.
Yeah.
So,
And you still have a pretty good relationship with her?
Oh, yeah. So does my current wife. Yeah, we get along. We
so she's benefited from the success of your sons as
absolutely,
well.
Absolutely.
Yeah. How did being financially stable and set, how did that change your life? Were you able to do things that you couldn't do before?
Well, most people that I know, I've known since I've been a kid. When I started Five Guys, I let three or four of my buddies that I went to high school with buy stock in my company because I thought it would be a great thing for them because they didn't have money. A little bit. They had a little bit of money, but not much. And one of them, I had to loan them the money. And they're all millionaires now.
Wow.
But we're still same old people. I mean, I just had a bunch of my friends down from Michigan a couple weeks ago on my boat in Florida. We drink beer together, and same as it was 30, 40 years ago.
And you can lead a pretty anonymous life. Like, no one, you're not walking around the street, and no one's like, oh, there's Jerry, the founder of Five Guys.
No, in fact, my wife always says she gets upset at me if I'm sitting out in the front yard eating a can of beans or something. And I always wear Levi's, I don't know how other people look at me, but I don't think any of us put on airs. I hope not.
Yeah, it's amazing. I was thinking back to what you said earlier that when you were a kid, the nuns said you were going to sell hamburgers.
Yeah.
What about your mom? I mean, what would she have thought about what you did with Five Guys hamburgers?
My mom liked hamburgers. She probably would have thought that was a good idea. In fact, my mom used to say, if you can make a good hamburger or serve a good drink or give a good haircut, you'll always...
have something to do, yeah.
Have an income. Yeah.
Jerry Morrell, founder of Five Guys Burgers and Fries. And if you add up all of the restaurants and franchises around the world, he says they are approaching $2 billion in revenue. By the way, for years, Five Guys resisted selling milkshakes. But about 2 years ago, after considerable debate, some stores decided to start selling them with mix-in flavors like peanut butter, banana, strawberries, salted caramel, and of course, why not? Bacon. And please do stick around because in just a moment, we're going to hear from you about the things you're building. But first, a quick thanks to one of our sponsors, National Geographic's Valley of the Boom. It's about the birth of the internet from bubble to bust. Sundays at 9, 8 Central on National Geographic. Watch the first two episodes on demand and on the Nat Geo TV app. Hey, thanks so much for sticking around because it's time now for How You Built That. And today we're updating a story we first ran about a year ago. And just a quick warning, if you're a parent of small children, you are about to hear about poop and barf because those two things are at the very heart of Hannah England's business. She has two small children of her own. And if you've ever wondered what happens inside one of those family changing rooms, well...
I walked into the bathroom and there were two moms. One was at the changing station and her baby had just had a blowout, like major, like up the back all the way to the neck kind of a thing. And this is going to be a situation that every mom gets themselves into.
And by the way, every dad, I mean, I've been there. And here's the thing, once you've cleaned up your kid, what are you supposed to do with all those soiled and disgusting clothes, especially when you're not at home?
You know, you kind of just cringe when you have to stick that in your diaper bag. And then when you have to open it after a full day, I mean, it is not pleasant.
Not to mention, after the clothes have festered in your diaper bag for a day, it may become impossible to get the stains out of them. Anyway, all of this got Hannah thinking.
I came up with this idea when I was putting my three-year-old to bed, and I came out to the living room and I just started describing to my sister-in-law and my husband this bag, this soaking bag, and I kept filling in the blanks. What if we could and what if it had this? And then they looked at me and they're like, well, it sounds like you just invented it.
And what Hannah envisioned was a watertight plastic bag that you could keep in your diaper bag. It would have a soap pod in it, kind of like the pod that goes into your dishwasher, so that when your kid pooped or barfed all over her clothes, you would just throw it in the bag, add water, and voila, the clothes would soak in soapy water while you went about your day.
And then I kind of just hit the ground running because I thought, I need this in my life.
So about 2 years ago, Hannah started calling manufacturers. They sent her prototypes of the plastic bags, and she and her husband began to test them.
We'd immediately fill it with water and seal it and hang it upside down in our living room and kitchen to look for drips and leaks, because we want these things to be able to hold up in a mom's diaper bag, and that's like going to combat.
But in those early days, nothing worked. The bags would break or the zippers would come undone and water would get everywhere. So Hannah kept calling around until she found one manufacturer in Wisconsin who seemed to know exactly what she needed.
And he goes, well, I think we're going with a seal that's actually really aggressive for your utility. And I said, exactly, I want it to be aggressive.
A seal so aggressive that you would have to use scissors to get it open. And then Hannah found another manufacturer to make a very gentle soap pod. And finally, she designed the outside of the bags with classy black and white stripes.
I wanted the design itself to not scream like, okay, this is a bag for soiled poop.
She then launched a Kickstarter campaign to raise about $12,000. And for a while, it looked like she wasn't going to make her goal. But then, kind of an amazing thing happened. The accounting software company QuickBooks found out about her. And QuickBooks has this program where it supports small businesses. And so someone from QuickBooks sent her a message via Kickstarter that basically said, hey, we're going to back you for the rest of the way.
It just showed up on our Kickstarter thing. And my husband, of course, was going, nope, this is some weird fraud thing. And I laughed at him and I'm like, what kind of fraud puts money into your bank account? Normally, they take money out.
Hannah was right. It was not fraud. And in December of 2017, she shipped her very first production run, about 5,000 bags, to those Kickstarter backers. Her company is called Wash It Later. And since we spoke to Hannah last year, the company has moved from her basement to an actual office. And about 2 months ago, they started selling a grab-and-go version of their diaper bag. It's become an even bigger success than their original product. If you want to learn more about Hannah and her company, Wash It Later, or hear previous episodes, head to our podcast page, howibuiltthis.npr.org. And of course, if you want to tell us your story, go to build.npr.org. We love hearing what you're up to. And thanks so much for listening to the show this week. You can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're there, please do give us a review. You can also write to us at hibt@npr.org. And if you want to send a tweet, it's @HowIBuiltThis. Our show was produced this week by Casey Herman, with music composed by Ramtin Arablouei. Thanks also to Mia Venkat, J.C. Howard, Noor Kutsi, Neva Grant, Sanaz Meshkinpour, and Jeff Rogers. Our intern is Candace Lim. I'm Guy Raz, and you've been listening to How I Built This from NPR.